DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Welcome to Living Planet. Coming up on the show today, we have stories of environmental change. We'll look at how gardeners in Spain are adapting to a changing climate. And we'll explore what climate insurance looks like in Uganda. But first, you've likely heard that the Amazon is burning. What does this mean for the world's largest tropical rainforest? My DW colleague Inika Mules has a quick rundown of what you need to know.
The Amazon rainforest has been burning since January, though it wasn't until July that the scale of the disaster, now visible from space, finally gained global attention. Thousands of fires are still blazing across the Amazon, the majority of which are in Brazil. In fact, nearly 30,000 square kilometres, or the equivalent of 4.2 million football fields, burned in August alone. The spike in fires has been blamed on deforestation and a practice known as slash-and-burn agriculture, in which natural vegetation is repeatedly cut down and burned in order to clear the land for cattle and crops. The practice is common in Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia. These types of fires can spread, as the forested region is currently in its annual dry season. The fires have also become a political issue. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has been under intense international scrutiny for his pro-business policies that have weakened environmental protections. Since he took office in January, the number of fires in Brazil has increased by 85%. But even before he became president, the rate of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon has increased by 60% under previous administrations since 2014. Firefighters and troops are working to contain the fires, but no one is sure when they will ultimately subside, or at least be under control.
Stretching across the northern half of South America, the Amazon isn't just contained in Brazil. And neither are its ongoing fires. According to official numbers, fires have burned more than 1 million hectares of dry forest and farmland across the border in Bolivia. Our reporter Lise Josephson-Herman visited the area to speak with those affected by the fires, including firefighters risking their lives to control the flames. Her report is narrated by Ruby Russell.
White and grey ash covers a vast cleared area in the middle of the dry Amazon forest. In Santa Rosa de Tucabaca, Bolivia's Chicatenea region has seen fires raging for the last month, and the ground is still glowing. Ronald Piccolomino Tacao is a tourist guide in the village of Robore in Chicatenea. He has been serving as a firefighter for over a month now. He recalls the many hours he spent trying to contain the fires.
It was like hell on earth. It was flames, smoke, things I can't explain. Imagine flames everywhere, fire everywhere, smoke and desperate people shouting, asking for water.
Drought in this eastern part of Bolivia has been severe this year. As in neighbouring Brazil, it's common practice to start controlled fires to prepare the soil for the next harvest. But many have spread out of control, morphing into wildfires. Lourdes Montero works for Oxfam Bolivia and is visiting the affected area in order to plan Oxfam's response to the situation caused by the massive wildfires.
It's bad that 1 million hectares have burned so far, out of a total of 16 million hectares that make up Chiquitania's forest in Bolivia.
Chiquitania has a very low population density, so the damage has been mainly environmental. But some indigenous people have been affected.
It is a territory that has two indigenous groups. They live in this area where they produce citrus fruits, beans, rice and corn, and these territories have been affected.
Vania Montenegro Aranibar is a local farmer from the village of Penil. She grows lemon, passion fruit and avocado trees. Vania Montenegro and her family were among those most affected by the fires. Tears come to her eyes as she remembers cooking lunch for her six children on a Saturday in mid-August. It was then that she noticed the fire.
Mis patos se quemaron.
My ducks burned. They burned completely. They died in half an hour because their feathers caught on fire. From mid-morning until 9 o'clock at night, we were fighting the fire as it came in. It was here, there, and everywhere. The fire surrounded my property.
The fires in Peniel have taken a toll on Vanya.
I'm very sad. I'm very sad how many animals must have been burned, how many species, trees. They are the lungs of the earth, the trees. It makes me really sad. We're destroying this world for our grandchildren.
In July, Bolivia's President Evo Morales passed legislation that encourages slash-and-burn farming as a way to create agricultural land. This in the run-up to a presidential election in October. The wildfires are being used on all sides to criticise political opponents. Vanya Montenegro explains that it's not the first time that wildfires have affected her community, but she hopes that the global attention will help change things.
This year, I don't know if it's because of the political campaigns, the world has suddenly showed solidarity with us. But I just want the fire to stop, because I love my plants, my animals, nature, and it has all been destroyed, maybe because of irresponsible people. We don't know who, but it has already destroyed more than 1 million hectares.
All over Chiquitania, frustration and sorrow at recent events was palpable for the immense area that was burned. Firefighters tried to control the massive fires, making their way through the dense forest with machetes, and then trying to control the fire with 20-litre water tanks on their backs. But the battle against the blaze seems one-sided, like an impossible fight for the firefighters to ever win. As both a firefighter and a nature lover, Ronald Piccolomino Tacao gets teary-eyed remembering the dramatic events of the last month.
One feels powerless. Powerless, but really, there is nothing else to do than to fight. We have to keep fighting for our family and nature.
Ronald talks about how he has seen a lot of wild animals suffering, monkeys, turtles, snakes, trying to escape the fire. He gets emotional, talking about the importance of the forest.
The Chiquitano forest is like our life, the future for our children. What's happening right now is something really painful. I don't have words for it. The forest is our life, not only for me and my family, but for everyone in the world.
Ronald is a father of three, and his children always ask him about the situation with the wildfires.
Sometimes I don't know how to tell them because it makes them sad, but really, they should know what's happening because this is their future.
There, we heard the personal agony experienced as these fires come within striking distance of people's homes. To unpack some of the ecological implications of what fires in the Amazon mean for countries in South America and for the world, I spoke with Quentin Lejeune, a climate scientist with the organization Climate Analytics. I started out by asking him what's happening to our planet when the Amazon burns as it has in this past month.
I think it's important to recall that land is currently a sink of carbon. So it means it's taking out carbon from the atmosphere. That means that land is actually currently slowing down climate change by absorbing carbon and storing it in the biomass through photosynthesis. And the Amazon ecosystems contribute greatly to this. And we know that climate change threatens to turn this land sink into a source of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere. And that would actually, instead of slowing down climate change, that would actually accelerate climate change, so exacerbate it. But if we look more locally, the Amazon rainforest plays also an important role in the climate of South America because through their leaves, tropical trees transpire vast amounts of water pumped into the soil, into the atmosphere, And this water is then transported by the atmosphere, and downwind it leads to rainfall in the forest. So this means tropical forests actually sustain the conditions that allow them to thrive, basically. But also they sustain precipitation for ecosystems and people that live up to thousands of kilometers downwind. So that's very important for the climate of the whole South America until the Rio de la Plata basin, basically where Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo and Uruguay are located.
The Amazon is often called the lungs of the planet. Could you explain a little bit what the Amazon provides for us when it comes to the air we breathe?
So because the Amazon basin contains very important rainforests, so the biggest rainforests we have on Earth, the photosynthesis is extremely active there. So this is indeed where a lot of transformation of carbon dioxide into oxygen happens. But it's an extremely important process because through photosynthesis, it produces oxygen. And also, as I said, it removes carbon out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, and stores it, thereby slowing down climate change.
Are these fires natural for the Amazon rainforest?
So we are currently in the dry season in the southern Amazon, at least. And that's the season where commonly we observe more fires at this time of the year. However, this year the increase seems to be more due to human activity than drought. So this and also the location of the fires points at the responsibility of human activities and especially farmers who want to clear forests to increase their agricultural land.
What do these fires mean for the biodiversity of the Amazon?
So, you know, the Amazon rainforest contains a tremendous amount of species. There was this study published in 2005 which said that the estimated proportion of Brazilian species was 9.5% of the world total, so just in Brazil, and most of it in the Amazon, and we keep discovering new species in the Amazon. So this is a hotspot of biodiversity. This is unique. This is unparalleled in the world. And fires lead to habitat destruction, so for biodiversity it's obviously a very bad thing because it reduces the area over which these species can thrive and can reproduce and can survive.
And some say the Amazon is approaching a tipping point. What does this mean for the planet exactly?
So what could happen because of a combined threat of climate change and deforestation is that would upset basically the recycling of precipitation by forests. So the mechanism of trees, tropical trees, pumping water into the soil, sending it into the atmosphere where it's transported downwind, leads to precipitation, which allows for forests to thrive, etc., etc. This we call precipitation recycling. And this can be upset by climate change because climate change leads to more intense and more frequent droughts in the Amazon. And this mechanism of precipitation recycling can also be upset by deforestation because the first deforestation, the vegetation, the tall vegetation types that replace trees have lower evapotranspiration rates. This means there is less water sent to the atmosphere. This means this precipitation recycling mechanism is basically weakened, and that could lead to less precipitation downwind of the Amazon rainforest or in the parts of the Amazon rainforest that are remote from the ocean, where the moisture comes from, meaning that eventually the conditions may not be there anymore for the forest to thrive, and it may just become too dry for it to survive, which may lead to forest turning into a savanna. That's what we call in terms of tipping points. And the importance of that process would be dramatic for the global climate because it would basically lead to immense release of carbon into the atmosphere. But what we're sure about is that the more we deforest and the more the planet warms, the closer we get to such a tipping point.
And what should we be doing about this?
We know that reducing and eventually halting deforestation is essential to remain under the 1.5 degree limit for global mean temperature increase compared to pre-industrial level, which is the limit that has been agreed upon by all countries under the Paris Agreement. And obviously the fact that deforestation rates are on the rise again in South America after having been decreased since beginning of the 2000s is extremely worrying because it's at odds with what we should be doing to reach the 1.5 degree goal.
That was Quentin Lejeune, a climate scientist with Climate Analytics. For more coverage of the Amazon and other fires burning around the world this summer, visit our website, dw.com/environment. Next up, we travel to Uganda, where farmers are looking for ways to ensure their livelihoods in unpredictable times. Stay tuned. While many try to stop or fix our changing environmental realities, others are looking for ways to better plan for a changing climate. For farmers around the world who have to rely on their crops each year for income, climate insurance may be a lifesaver as annual harvests become less predictable. After all, if you can insure your car or your house, why not insure your farm? Our reporter Wambi Michael went to find out how exactly these climate insurance plans work. His report is narrated by Azumta Lattice.
Agriculture is the source of income for most of the African countries like Uganda, but extreme weather from drought to flooding is becoming an increasingly frequent problem. Farmers have been battered by weather. It's either been too wet or dry. Both destroy harvests. As climate conditions become more volatile in Uganda and other African countries, weather-based index insurance schemes have been developing to help protect agricultural investments. Bruce Campbell is director of the research program on climate change, agriculture and food security at CGAIR. He has studied this type of insurance in 18 African countries, including Kenya, Nigeria, Uganda and Zimbabwe.
Index insurance is a really neat product because in the old days with an insurance industry, you must get somebody to go out and look if there's been damage, and then there'll be a payout, and the payout will come long after the damage occurred. With index insurance, it's based on an index. So if the rainfall drops below a certain amount, then the insurance company knows the crop has failed and they will pay out the money immediately. This means the farmer gets the money back in his pocket and he doesn't have to sell his assets in order to survive.
Previously, insurance companies would not cover anything that could be considered an act of God. But with governments offering insurance subsidies, insurance firms are now going a step further so that these climate change-induced events don't leave the farmer totally broke. Robert Serwanga is an agriculture reinsurance consultant working with Ugandan insurance firms to design packages to insure against climate risks.
Weather has been responsible for up to 60% of losses in agriculture. It has not been predictable whether the weather is going to be good or bad, meaning that people who have invested in agriculture have lost lump sums of money because they didn't know what would happen. Today, it's no more, because we have got products which can insure you against the weather and especially drought and excessive rainfall. Those products are now available in Uganda. So a farmer can go into a season to plant whatever they're going to plant, pay their insurance, and in case the weather doesn't respond the way it's supposed to, then it's compensated up to the yield he was supposed to get from the farm.
Studies have shown that higher temperatures and long spells of drought, as well as excessive rainfall, are negatively impacting coffee production in Africa. The African Fine Coffee Conference in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, this year heard that Africa could lose up to 1 million bags of coffee to climate change-related conditions. For Uganda, studies have shown that the lowest Arabica coffee growing areas are likely to become completely unsuitable for coffee. That would mean farmers are likely to switch to other crops. The National Union of Coffee, Agribusiness and Farm Enterprise in Uganda has mobilized its members to insure their coffee against climate change. Nuagaba Deyasu is the Deputy Executive Director of this coffee farmers' organization.
We found it very wise that coffee being a very big business and taking care of almost 90% of the needs of the household, it was important that they can ensure the income that comes from coffee to be able to have income when there is drought. Climate change is becoming more and more serious. So this, we thought this was a very good, adaptation measure.
He says insured coffee farmers are expanding their farms knowing that they are cushioned in case of drought. To be able to provide an insurance product, an insurer always has to define and monitor the conditions very carefully. They have to be sure that the customer will only be paid if the insurance claim is based on the events defined in the policy. So in Uganda and Senegal in West Africa, insurers are taking advantage of technologies like satellite data that reduces the cost of having assessors visit individual farmers, says Robert Serwanga.
We use the satellite. After a farmer enrolls for insurance or pays premium for a particular season, then the area where there is a satellite set to you, the particular farmer, to measure the amount of water in that area. And that one is measured against the ideal. So if you got less than ideal, you are compensated the percentage of deficit from the ideal.
Traveling 50 kilometers west from Uganda's capital, we meet James Musule, a coffee farmer who has taken advantage of micro weather index insurance.
Development in a business.
I decided to insure my coffee because it is a business. When drought hits the coffee plant, you lose almost an entire year of production. It can even take 2 years for you to recover. So I would have lost too much if I suffered drought for two consecutive years.
Armed with a simple smartphone, Musule is able to access reliable satellite information, which he uses to protect his crop. He also gets information on when to plant other crops. 70 kilometers away from Musule's coffee farm is Lord Wine Muhwezi's maize farm. The first time he insured his crops against drought, he had a claim and got paid. The next time, he paid the premium, but the season was good, so no compensation was received. Then came the destructive pest known as the fall armyworm, which is spreading across sub-Saharan Africa.
It really did us bad. The policy had actually taken was covering not just the dry spell, but even pests and diseases. Anything that could happen on the farm was all insured. So it kind of like gives you a little bit of security knowing that in case something goes wrong, you have a fallback.
So could climate or agriculture insurance similar to those operating in 18 African countries work for the rest of Africa? Robert Serwanga again.
The highest growing population in the world is in Africa. So we have to improve productivity of our land. Now, when we have risk mitigating solutions like agriculture insurance, this is where every country should come to protect their farmers from drought. And that's what reinsurance is. So all other African countries need to benefit.
When the risks involved in agriculture are insured, more and more banks will be prepared to provide loans to farmers to improve their technologies and increase their productivity.
That report by Wambi Michael was narrated by Assumpta Lattice. Insurance is one way to accept the new realities of a changing climate. Another is actually adapting what you grow in the garden. Recent droughts and heat waves in Europe have proved difficult for gardeners and farmers on the continent. So how do people in Spain, with its traditionally very dry climate, manage to maintain their thriving gardens? Here's what some gardeners in Madrid are doing to adjust to even hotter, drier summers. Their tips might just come in handy for your garden.
At a community garden in the north of Madrid, parents and their children meet up to tend to their flowers and vegetables. 8-year-old Hugo remembers the giant harvest last year, and he's looking forward to this summer's crop.
Well, here we have lettuce. We've also planted, I think, peas, artichokes, and radishes.
Alcachofas y rábanos.
Another child taps Ugo on the shoulder and gestures with his hands, outlining the shape of a large beach ball.
Ah, las calabazas gigantes.
The giant pumpkins. Yes, it's a meter across, more or less.
And this in a city which, on average, only gets 60 days of rain a year. Madrid's high summer temperatures of 35 to 40 degrees Celsius, or more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit, make things challenging for backyard gardeners. But Javi, who lives nearby, explains why people here are still able to keep their gardens growing. They just plant vegetables that need very little water, choosing varieties that survive even down south in Andalusia, for example.
The typical summer dish in Andalucía is gazpacho, a cold soup made with raw tomatoes, cucumbers and peppers, vegetables from Andalucía where it practically never rains. Here there's a little more rain, so we can grow them, no problem.
But when the sun really begins to beat down on Madrid, gardeners do have to help out with some very careful irrigation.
In between our plants, we've laid out hoses pierced with small holes, which supply the roots of the plants with water, drop by drop. No huge spray of water, no flooded flower beds. The system is controlled automatically. We have to program it, so water will only flow every few days for a limited time. And then, for example, it releases at 4 a.m. every 4 days. And because it only comes out drop by drop, the quantity of water used is minimal.
The situation is different in Madrid's landscaped parks. To have a nice expanse of green lawn like those that are famous in the UK and the US, you can't skimp on water. José María is a professional gardener and takes care of several green spaces in the Spanish capital. He says perfect green lawns are the hardest thing to maintain in a hot, dry city. If lawns in Madrid aren't watered daily in the summer, preferably at night, they'll promptly be scorched brown.
Madrid no es un clima de...
Madrid's climate is not suited for lawns or gardens. For a 400 square meter garden, of which 200 square meters is grass, irrigation will cost more than 1,000 euros, and that's only for the summer.
For that reason, perfect green lawns in Madrid tend to be found around the city's upmarket villas. More common is another grass variety, gramón, which is much easier to care for, says Javi.
It's a type of grass that needs very little water. And then, well, it will be very good. In the winter it looks a bit battered, but I enjoy it in the summer. It's very nice. It primarily needs sunlight, but when it comes to water, it requires very little.
Thanks to Gramón, Madrid is one of the world's greenest cities with around 6,400 hectares of green space and 300,000 trees, or a tree for every 20 inhabitants. This works only because the city has planted tree varieties that can survive with very little water. A few trees also shade the community garden. Héctor, another junior gardener, lists off the different types with a little help from Lola.
Here we have a pear tree, a cherry tree, an apple tree,
and a quince tree.
With robust grass and some planning, Madrid's gardening enthusiasts are able to keep things green with barely any water. And, they point out, they don't have to give up anything, despite a climate that appears to be anything but garden-friendly.
Kathleen Schuster presented that report by Oliver Neurath. And as summer comes to a close here in Germany, so too does this edition of Living Planet. If you have questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to address, get in touch by sending us an email or voice memo to livingplanet@dw.com. As always, don't forget to subscribe to Living Planet wherever you get your podcasts. We'd also love it if you recommend us to a friend or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the show. Our studio manager this week was Celestine Wasike. Lena Hille was our studio technician. Ina Camules helped with production. And I'm Sam Baker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the globe.